Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. Today, we will be reading the following articles: The Green Bay Model Railroaders Club, and How to Model Realistic Streets. The first article is The Green Bay Area Model Railroaders Club, A Club Serving a Community, by Dave Rickaby, photos by the author. When someone mentions the city of Green Bay, Wisconsin, there's a high percentage of probability that the first thing that comes to mind is the National Football League's esteemed franchise Green Bay Packers and the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field. Though this is a notable and current piece of Green Bay history, it's not the complete picture. Green Bay's history goes all the way back to its initial visit in 1634 by French explorer Jean Nicolet. By 1655, a trading post had been established along with a trade route following the Fox, Wisconsin, and finally Mississippi rivers. Fast forward 120 years, and the area had flourished into a busy Great Lakes port. Eventually, railroads would follow, serving the paper mills, canneries, stockyards, and other industries of the Fox Valley. The one thing about history is that if you don't document it, then it tends to be forgotten. The railroad landscape around Green Bay has changed over the years. Most people associate Titletown with the Chicago and Northwestern, Green Bay and Western, and Milwaukee Road. Line sales saw new faces come to town in the late 1980s and early 1990s, such as the Fox River Valley Railroad and later Wisconsin Central. Today, Canadian National, Escanaba and Lake Superior, and Fox Valley and Lake Superior serve the area. One of the facets of model railroading is keeping that history alive. This is the call of all model railroaders, and one club has picked up that torch. This is the story of the Green Bay Area Model Railroaders Club, or GBAMRC. The Club's Journey. The Green Bay Area Model Railroaders Club's story begins with the establishment of the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay in 1956. In 1958, the museum received congressional approval as the only national railroad museum in the United States. A small loop of track, maintained to this day for running a full-size train ride, and a small depot were built on the grounds. The depot had offices, bathrooms, exhibits, and a gift shop. Through further expansion and acquisition of more locomotives and rolling stock, several new buildings were erected on the museum's campus. In the mid-1980s, the gift shop was moved to a new location on the property, which left a large, empty space in the depot. Around the same time, a small group of model railroaders had built a layout in an old baggage car that was on the museum grounds. With the thought of melding prototype and model railroading together at the museum, Warren Mott, who was the general museum manager, approached local hobby shop owner Jim Prokash with the idea of filling the empty space in the depot with a model railroad. Jim was able to pull a couple dozen model railroaders together, including those from the baggage car layout. In short time, formal incorporation documents were drawn up and voted on. In 1987, the Green Bay Area Model Railroaders Club was established, with Jim Prokash as its first president. The premise of the original HO scale layout was to represent the steam and diesel eras between 1950 and 1980. The model railroad was to act as a display layout and to be interactive for the public. The layout was built in place as a permanent piece with the premise that it would always be there. As with most clubs, however, nothing lasts forever. By 2008, the GBAMRC was looking for a new home. In 2009, Paul Pasiewicz, owner of Engine House Services in Green Bay, alerted the club that there was an empty store next to his hobby shop. After approaching the owner, the club moved in with the understanding that they would have to vacate the premises upon request. Because they understood that this was only temporary, they decided to build the new layout in a modular form. The club developed standards that would make it possible to take the new layout apart and move it to storage or to a more permanent home. The club proceeded to design and build a small 40-inch by 48-foot linear layout. Dick Farine, another former club president, told the membership of the possibility that a space might be available elsewhere that could make a good home for the club. He reported that there was a large, empty room in the lower level of the Kress Family Library in nearby De Pere, Wisconsin. Dick reached out to Dr. Watermullen, Brown County Library Board president, to arrange for the club officers to look at the space and discuss possible lease options. This resulted in the club signing its first 5-year lease agreement beginning October 15, 2011. The empty space was approximately 6,000 square feet. As part of the agreement, both the library and the club worked together to create a usable space by adding electrical outlets, lighting, and additional heating. The walls were already drywalled from the floor to about 12 feet high. Shortly after the room was completed, the club members moved the modular layout from the former storefront location to the lower level of the library. Work on the present model railroad started in 2011/2012. The layout. The club named its freelance line the Wisconsin Northern Railroad to reflect the region and the railroads that served it. The model railroad is set between 1950 and 1976. Built as a freestanding island layout with three peninsulas and staging, the model railroad has a footprint of 26 by 68 feet with a ruling grade of 3%. With a base elevation of 42¾ inches at Menasha City, the model railroad rises to a summit of 49½ at Winnebago. The minimum radius on the main line is 42 inches, and the minimum mainline turnouts are number 8. The layout has an approximately 2,000-foot mainline run, almost 33 square miles, and 5,500 feet of track. A train running at 50 square miles per hour takes 20 minutes to orbit the layout. The model railroad is set up for continuous operation, which is handy during open houses. During operating sessions, the layout is run point to point to and from the staging yards. The current layout was built in a modular fashion. The club learned a valuable lesson when it had to vacate the depot at the National Railroad Museum. That layout was specifically built to fit in that space. It wasn't designed to be relocated. The modular sections are built as 2x4-foot open grid boxes from 1x4s. The legs supporting the boxes are constructed with 2x2s. The entire model railroad is braced from section to section and is quite solid. The track work is Atlas Code 100 flex track with Pico Code 100 turnouts. All of the track is laid on Midwest Products cork roadbed and weathered. Tortoise by Circuitron switch machines control most of the turnouts, which are lined using toggle switches on the fascia. The rest of the turnouts are manually lined with Caboose Industries ground throws. Although the club owns approximately 500 pieces of rolling stock and close to 50 locomotives, members are encouraged to run their own equipment as long as they are equipped with Katie couplers and metal wheel sets. The layout is controlled by Digitrax Digital Command Control, or DCC. The club has several throttles at its disposal. A few members prefer to use an app on their smartphones to operate trains. Some club members have direct current locomotives, so the layout is wired to accept one DC train at a time. Scenery. The landforms around the layout were created by carving extruded foam insulation board and covering it with a layer of plaster. Most of the ground cover is from woodland scenics. However, over the years, the club has received donations of scenery materials, including trees and ground cover. These generously donated materials are put to good use. The rock work is made using rubber molds and a soupy plaster mix. The finished castings are painted with various earth tone acrylic paints. The water areas were created by first painting the bottoms for depth. After the paint had dried, the perimeter of each area was sealed in preparation for pouring two-part resin. The club used Magic Water by Unreal Details for its water features. The deciduous trees come from a variety of sources, such as sedum and other weeds. Some of the conifers were handmade using the bottle brush method. Others were purchased. Some of the structures on the layout were scratch-built, including the Green Bay Depot, the Escanaba Ore Dock, a Red Owl grocery store, a machine shop, and all of the Jimco Lumber Company buildings. The depot was built by a college student who was studying architectural industrial modeling. He used plexiglass as the form for the structure and added brick paper and plastic windows and doors. The depot first appeared on the original club layout at the National Railroad Museum. The ore dock was built by Elmer D. Johnson in 1980. He visited the prototype dock in Escanaba, Michigan, and took a lot of measurements. This model was also on the original layout and is a compressed version of the prototype. The boat sitting next to the dock was donated to the club and then finished by club member Greg Amato. The backdrop is 1/8-inch tempered hardboard. The area behind the Green Bay Depot and yard has photo backdrops. All of the other backdrops were hand-painted. The fascia is also 1/8-inch tempered hardboard. Black skirting hangs from bottom edge to hide the benchwork. The layout is divided into two boosters and a Digitrax DCS-240 command station. Each of those three layout sections are run by Digitrax PM42 quad power managers. The mainline, yards, and sidings are separated from each other. This way, if a locomotive derails and the wheels cause a short, the whole layout doesn't shut down. The layout room is illuminated with 15 4-foot fluorescent fixtures. As part of the agreement with the Kress Family Library, the library installed the lighting fixtures and supplied a furnace to heat the basement. Operations. The GBAMRC loves to operate its layout. Each session typically hosts between 8 and 10 operators. In the event that there is a new member who wants to learn about model railroad operations, he or she is paired with an experienced operator. A normal operating session can last from 2 to 3 hours. During an operating session, the club runs up to 15 trains, though only 9 jobs are scheduled. Each of these jobs have specific switching duties in certain towns and industries. These are each given an Alpha Code designation, such as FTHO, which stands for Fort Howard Switching, and deals only with the Fort Howard Paper Mill Factory. During communications between the crews and the dispatcher, the trains are referred to by their lead unit number. Passenger trains and ore movements have priority over other trains on the main line. There are usually 2 yardmasters and a dispatcher. Dispatching is primarily done giving virtual mainline authority, which is communicated to the crews via a phone intercom system. The crews call the dispatcher when they are ready to depart their respective yard. Once granted authority, they will proceed to their destination. After they have arrived at their work location and have exited the main line, they are responsible for calling the dispatcher to clear their authority. The same happens in reverse. Once a train approaches its home yard, the operator calls the yardmaster to find out which track to arrive on. All of the car forwarding is done using computer-generated switch lists. The wheel report includes the car type and location where it is to be spotted. The club uses visual guides for operators. These include small tags with the appropriate siding or spur number on them. The small color-coded tags are placed between the ties with numbers that correspond to red numbers on the switch lists. At each town and or industry, there's also a schematic showing the track plan of each industry. These guides help make the flow of operations easier to understand for new and experienced club members alike. The operating sessions are also open to the public. If someone expresses interest in participating in an operating session, they can contact any member of the club to be signed up. When they arrive at the club, they will be paired with an experienced operator. Operating sessions are held on the first Sunday of the month, unless it falls on a holiday. Operating sessions are put on hiatus during the summer months, June, July, and August. Into the future. A future goal is to add another peninsula in a semi-finished state to demonstrate the STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, aspect of the hobby to kids that come through during the library's story time. This way, people can see not only the difference between a finished and a semi-finished layout, but what it takes to build it and bring it to a finished state. This includes things such as carpentry, wiring, modeling, research, and all the rest of the hidden aspects of the layout building process. One of the visions of former club president and current member, John Grom, was to elevate the look and operation of the layout to the point where it could be published in a model railroad magazine. That tradition has been carried forth, and his vision has been accomplished. To learn more about the Green Bay Area Model Railroaders Club, visit the group's Facebook page, facebook.com/GBAMRC/, or send an email to gbamrc@gmail.com. The next article is How to Model Realistic Streets. Use scribing tools, paint, and washes to enhance plaster pavement. By Pell K. Serberg. Photos by the author. Ever since I built my first layout back in the 1990s, I've been struggling with making my streets and roads look more realistic. Every time I start a new layout, I've tried to improve my methods. They definitely started to look better on my last model railroad, but I still wasn't fully pleased with the results. When I started on two FreeMo modules, I set a goal to make the streets look better than my prior efforts. As before, I used Woodland Scenics Smooth It. I've always preferred to make my streets and roads from plaster. Plaster has a realistic concrete or asphalt feel to it. I assume other types of plaster will work, but I've always used Smooth It and saw no reason not to use it again here. The material is easy to work with and easy to sand too. The big difference this time around is how I finished the roads. On previous layouts, I primarily used paint and saved the washes as a final touch to bring out recessed details. This time around, I used paint sparingly and let washes do the heavy lifting. This gave the road surface the uneven, random gray look I'd hoped for. If you need to add streets to your model railroad, I hope you give these easy-to-follow techniques a try. All of the materials are readily available at well-stocked brick-and-mortar and online hobby shops. Though you can model the streets to look newly poured, I find adding grooves, cracks, and washes really brings them to life. Step 1. Pouring and spreading. I started by applying Woodland Scenics paving tape, an approximately 60 thousandths of an inch thick foam tape, along the outside edge of the street I was working on. Then I mixed the same company's Smooth It with water. The thinner the mix, the greater the risk of air bubbles. If the mix is too thick and the material is difficult to spread evenly, as it has a tendency to stick to the screed. I then poured the plaster on the street. Do this carefully to avoid creating air bubbles. I distributed the Smooth It inside of the paving tape form with a wood craft stick. Try not to apply more plaster than needed to fill the area. Finally, I spread the plaster evenly with a styrene screed. Apply just enough pressure to the screed so it barely stays on the top of the paving tape. If the plaster sticks to the screed, dip it in water before spreading the plaster. If you discover too many dips or holes in the surface after you have spread the plaster, apply a little more plaster to those spots and spread it with the screed again. The plaster has a working time of approximately 15 minutes before it begins to set. After the plaster had cured, I sanded the surface with fine sandpaper wrapped around a wood block. Remove any dust residue in preparation for the next step. Step 2. Curb appeal. To model curbs, I applied another layer of Woodland Scenics paving tape on top of the existing tape. Then I ran a second course of foam tape inside and parallel to the new tape. I left a 100 thousandth of an inch gap between the tape strips. This groove formed the curbs. Next, using a pipette, I applied water in the groove to moisten the dry plaster. If you don't wet the existing plaster before you apply a new layer, it will absorb the moisture from the wet plaster and shorten the working time of the new plaster. Additionally, the new layer of plaster will not adhere well to the first layer. I filled the groove with plaster and pressed the material down with a wood craft stick to eliminate any air bubbles. Then I smoothed the plaster with a styrene screed and let it set. When the plaster had cured completely, no cool damp spots, I removed the paving tape. I then sanded the edge of the curb round using a homemade sanding tool that I fashioned from a woodcraft stick, double-sided tape, and sandpaper. For information on using paving tape and smooth it to model city streets, sidewalks, alleys, and highways, as well as some additional painting and weathering techniques, check out my article, Modeling Streets and Highway, in the August 2015 issue of Model Railroader magazine. Step 3. An easy transition. Next, I turned my attention to the driveways. I outlined a slightly sloped driveway with bits of styrene and filled the area with plaster. As before, I wet the existing plaster where the driveway joined the street. I spread the plaster evenly with a screed, starting at the street and moving away. I didn't remove the styrene frame until the plaster was dry. Even though plaster doesn't stick very well to styrene, use caution when removing the frame so you don't chip or break the material. You may also consider applying mold release to the styrene prior to pouring the smooth-it. When the plaster had cured, I sanded the driveway with fine sandpaper. The sanding sometimes reveals small holes caused by air bubbles. To repair them, I wet the area and carefully filled the holes with more smooth-it plaster. After the patches had dried, I lightly sanded the street surface one more time. Step 4. Adding details. With the plaster work completed, I started detailing the streets. First, I used a scribing tool to add grooves along the curb. I used styrene strip to keep the lines as straight as possible. Next, I used the scribing tool to add cracks in the asphalt. A little of this goes a long way, so add the cracks sparingly. When in doubt, use prototype photos as a guide. Notice how the primary crack in the street I modeled runs down the center line, parallel to the curbs. The other cracks spider out from there, perpendicular to and terminating at the curbs. Finally, I added a storm drain made from styrene sheet and strip. The manhole cover is an injection-molded plastic casting from William K. Walther's Incorporated. Step 5. A realistic finish. I turned to a multi-step process to finish the streets. First, I used an airbrush to apply a base coat of light sand beige that I mixed with one part Model Master sand, number 1706, and two parts white, number 1768. Both of these enamel colors have been discontinued by the Tester Corporation. Hornby, Revel, and Tamiya are three firms that offer enamel hobby paint. After the paint dried, I lightly sanded it with fine grit sandpaper. Then I applied a wash, which I made with Vallejo Black, number 71.057, Camouflage Black Brown, number 71.042, and plenty of the same company's airbrush thinner, 71.161. Notice how I kept the brush parallel to the curbs. I applied one coat of the wash to the curb and driveway. Since asphalt is darker than concrete, the paved areas received three coats. I let each dry between applications. The wash brought out the grooves and cracks in the surface and dried in a non-uniform gray. I finished the project by adding scenery and details to the adjacent terrain. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with Aftersight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at aftersight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@aftersight.org. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.